the Assistant Secretary of Defense during the Reagan years. He was a much decorated Marine officer who fought in Vietnam and, of course, retired as a full-bird colonel. And certainly one of my favorite guests. Now, of course, he works full-time trying to get the information out to people about the moral breakdown within our society and really within the military. You can't have a military that will fight, will fight bravely unless it has a moral foundation. Men are not going to fight simply for money as mercenaries, or a few of them will, but that's not the sort of man you want fighting for America. Religious faith has been the foundation of America since the time of the Revolutionary War, when our deeply committed founding fathers, certainly were praying, were looking to God for guidance, and America never would have been established as a free nation had it not been for divine intervention. And those of you who have heard the stories of George Washington, being in the fights with Indians, and they're firing at him and they're hitting him time and time and time again, and none of the bullets ever penetrate him, and they shoot the horses out from underneath him, and all the other officers are killed, and George Washington is not. And his prayers, and you realize, of course, that God did intervene to bring about this nation. Now, of course, those of you who listen to our programs on a regular basis realize that there are two forces at work in our society. One is the strong Christian, and one is God's hand on this country, which on two occasions has given us great revivals, certainly in 1740, and then in the mid-1800s. We had revivals, and the people turned back to God. But, today, I believe the only thing that could possibly save America would be another great revival, another great awakening. But you have to understand there's a conspiracy against God. It's in our schools, it's within our churches, and they're changing the music and the message of our churches. But it's also within our military. And this is one of the frightening things that's happening, whether it be the Virginia Military Academy, or whether it be the Air Force Academy, or whether it be in Annapolis, or whether it be at West Point. There's an organized effort to have the ministers or the chaplains stop praying in the name of our Lord Jesus Christ, and to attack anybody who talks about Christianity openly. Oh, it's all right if you want to be in your room praying. Just don't pray too loud, so we wouldn't want anybody to be offended by your prayers. America was founded by Christians as a Christian nation. Yes, the wicked people weren't there at that time. But they have certainly never, of course, been as forthright as they are today in taking over control of this nation. And this is why I believe we're in the latter days, because there is such an organized, orchestrated effort at every level of our society to undermine Christianity, whether it be in Christmas, to take the Christ out of Christmas, or whether it would be in our schools, to take God and prayer and the Ten Commandments out of our schools, whether to take the Ten Commandments out of our public places. There is a conspiracy against God, and it is being fought at least one place within our military, and Colonel Ron Ray, our guest, is right on the front lines of that battle. Colonel, thank you so much for being with us.
Dan, it's always a privilege to be with you. I enjoy it very much.
Well, now, what aspect are we going to talk about today?
Well, you suggested that I think this whole controversy about these general officers that has been taken the time, retired general officers who've been criticized the administration and the conduct of the Iraq War, has raised the whole proper question about what's the proper role, of our military and the relationship between the military and what we hear so much now said is the civilian control of the military. But that's a word that came out of the whiz kids that worked under Robert McNamara in the Kennedy administration. Prior to that time, it was clearly understood in America that the civil authority over our armed forces is the U.S. Congress.
Hold that thought. We'll be back in just a moment here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay. Our guest this afternoon is Colonel Ron Ray, formerly Assistant Secretary of Defense in the Reagan administration, and certainly retired Marine Corps colonel. And today we're going to be talking about what's happened recently. Six generals have spoken out against Donald Rumsfeld's handling of the war, not letting the military win the war or do anything that was right. And in fact, one of them certainly was a general who was actually, I believe his name is Paul Eaton. He was appointed the job of rebuilding the Iraqi army of a nation of 25 million people. They gave him six men to do it with. I mean, if you haven't read my newsletter where I go into the background of that, no wonder he's bitter. I mean, why have we have to keep our troops there? Because they did everything they could to block rebuilding the Iraqi army. They've done everything wrong, and you couldn't do this bad a job unintentionally. And I think I'm proud of these officers for having the courage to speak out. So you pick up the story there, Colonel.
Well, it's an interesting thing. I was in Vietnam with Anthony Zini, Tony Zini, a retired four-star general at CENTCOM. And he followed, really, the first guy who spoke out. They didn't go back to talk about it, Joe Hoare. I was also in Vietnam with him, advisors to the Vietnamese Marines in 1967. He was the chief of staff under Norm Schwarzkopf when we went into the first Gulf War, and then when he retired, he took over Schwarzkopf's job as a four-star. And he's the first one who called as a retired general back all the way back in April of 2003. He calls for a full Senate hearing an investigation on the Iraq War debacle, which he called it at that particular point. And the question always was this. There's no question we didn't have enough troops. There was no, I mean, every military thinker, you didn't need to be a general to see that. And General Sinsicki, the chief of staff of the Army at the time, said we need at least 300,000. Remember that we took half a million men and women. 35, nearly 40,000 American women in a combat theater in 1990-91 in the first Gulf War. This time, Sinsicki said we can't do it with less than 300,000, and he was fired. And they reached down to all the Army generals, and there wasn't a single Army general selected as chief of staff. They went to the retired list, and Peter Schumacher was picked up. But his comments were really strong. Joe Hoare analyzed this very well, and anybody that's interested in that can contact us, at 1-800-837-0544 or contact me at colonelray@aye.net, colonelray@aye.net, and I can give them the details.
Hold that thought there for just a moment, Colonel. We'll be right back. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Our guest is Colonel Ron Ray, and he was just saying that, you know, when we went into Desert Storm, the attack on Kuwait in 1991, while we had, actually, there were about 695,000 troops deployed, there were about 500,000 that were used, 500,000 to chase Saddam out of Kuwait. And yet 160,000 to invade Iraq and try to hold it. Everybody knew, the generals knew, it wasn't going to be enough. And yet, of course, Rumsfeld insisted that you do it my way or the highway. And they just simply got rid of any of the generals who objected to it. And some of the generals did speak out at that time, and they were dismissed. And so this is Rumsfeld's war. And it has been prolonged unnecessarily. An awful lot of people have died because of Donald Rumsfeld. And yet he has the full backing of the president, who, of course, avoided military service himself during Vietnam. And we're sending our boys over there into simply a meat grinder. And I'm so proud of these six generals who have had the courage to speak out and say, this is wrong.
And it's a proper role. You know, they're retired now. They're speaking out. They took an oath to uphold and defend the Constitution. But it's been very interesting. A lot of the talking heads, a lot of the people have been extremely critical of them. The Wall Street Journal editorial here in April, honor and discretion, conduct unbecoming from retired generals by a man named Elliot A. Cohen, who is a professor at Johns Hopkins and writes on military affairs. But that's been particularly in the Washington Times, which is supposed to be the owned by Rupert Murdoch's company. And
No, Washington Times is of Reverend Moon.
I'm sorry.
Washington Times is Reverend Moon.
That's right, and they've been very critical. Maureen Dowd, they called it a mutiny. Hell no, we won't go. But I can tell you that we're seeing people vote with their feet about this war in terms of military officers. We spend the old adage used to be it cost the taxpayers about $1 million to educate a young officer at one of our service academies. 4 years of all that training, everything's worth about $1 million in actual cost, and a growing number, about a third who were commissioned in 2000. In other words, and if you take that that West Point, you have a 5-year obligation, and if you take an ROTC or an NROTC scholarship in the Navy, the Air Force, the Marines, or the Army, you have a 4-year obligation, and you go to a civilian college, and your full tuition is paid for. A third got out at the end of their 5-year commitment from the class of 2000 from West Point, and similar numbers were getting out. So what we're seeing is that this repeated deployment, and remember, the original call was that this was going to be a cakewalk, they were going to be greeted as liberators, they were going to be throwing flowers at them when they came into Iraq, just like they did when we got into France during World War II. And then what Joe Hoare pointed out, again, a friend of mine, a very able officer, CENTCOM commander, that is responsible for that whole region, followed Norm Schwarzkopf. He said, they told us it was going to be a shock and awe, and we were going to win very quickly. And now we're talking about, Dick Cheney's talking about a generation of war, and talking about it going to last for decades. What is this, you know? What is this? And if they don't tell the American people, we're certainly not going to hear it from the media. We certainly haven't heard it from the administration. And until John Murtha, the Democrat from Pennsylvania, a Marine veteran of Vietnam, finally spoke up and said, let's get them out of there in 6 months and put a reaction force in Kuwait if we absolutely need to do something that is of military nature, but let's get them out in 6 months.
I know, right? We actually have a video. It's called The Day That Changed America Forever. It's put together by a good friend, Dave Wagner. But here's a clip right after 9-1-1 where they're interviewing various people, and one of them is talking about, well, the president may be able to use this tragedy, you know, to carry out what his father wanted, New World Order. And then, of course, they interview the premier of Canada, who said, this war will go on forever. I mean, they knew exactly what was going on at that time. They just didn't want the American people to know that they're going to continue sending our boys over there into the meat grinder.
Well, you're right in a way. I mean, Irving Kristol, the father of the so-called neocons, and wrote in 1996 in the Wall Street Journal, he said, what we really need is we need a new enemy that would unite us in opposition, that can pull us together. In other words, what America needs is a new enemy. And he wrote that in the Wall Street Journal, and of course the neocons in this administration that came in really under, to a certain extent, under Ronald Reagan, but George W. Bush brought many, many of them in. Scooter Libby is, of course, one of them. He's under indictment, and you might saw the other day in the press that they refused to dismiss the complaint that there had been an extensive motion filed that said that the special prosecutor who was doing this case wasn't constituted correctly and didn't have the authority to do it, and that was thrown out. And there's going to be an interesting criminal trial of two former AIPAC officials who likewise were involved in giving classified information to Israeli officials, and that those criminal trials should occur here in the next 30 days. They have not been deferred after the election, the way Scooter Libby's trial was deferred. But there's now at least 8 who've spoken out, and that doesn't include Joe Hoare, who spoke out right away in April of 2003. So a number of our, not just brigadier generals, our 2- and 3-star, Marine 3-star general Paul Van Riper, became the 8th U.S. general who, back on the 24th, called. They're all saying that Rumsfeld should resign. Now, that's pretty strong talk, but there's certainly nothing seditious about it. There's nothing that's unconstitutional or improper from that. This is not the first time there's been an effort to muzzle our military leadership, and that the first guy who did that in a major league way was Robert McNamara, and there were some really important hearings that if anybody would like to get a transcript of those hearings, I've got a summary of that. John Stennis, distinguished chairman of the Armed Services Committee, held hearings on the muzzling of the military in 1962, because the American tradition has always been, while the president, as commander-in-chief, might command the loyalty of our military, and might have an administration policy that they get on board behind, Congress, during hearings in the Armed Services Committee, both in the House and the Senate, always knew that they could turn to the general and say, now, General, I understand that you're supporting the policy of the administration, but give the Congress, give us, the members of the committee, your personal views of this matter. Do you see problems and things that you personally feel? They always had that right, and that's what McNamara. And it was interesting to me that a year or so ago, Donald Rumsfeld had Robert McNamara in for lunch, and publicly for us to all see that he was calling on Robert McNamara for advice.
Well,
which shouldn't give the mothers and fathers of America much comfort.
I agree with you totally. It was very interesting on 60 Minutes why they were interviewing Congressman Murtha, Mike Wallace, in his smug way. But say, well, now, Congressman, all the generals, you know, we've talked to, they all support the administration. And Murtha looked into the camera and he said, well, that's not what they tell me off camera. And Mike Wallace looked surprised. You know, well, how could that be? I mean, the generals all tell us they support it. Well, of course, you know, if they're in, you know, over there, they have to say they support it. But the generals are coming to Congress, to Congressman Murtha, and saying, you've got to get the information out. They're killing our boys in industry.
Well, there's no question about it. And according to a major article that came out here within the last, on the 24th of April, young officers are joining the debate over Rumsfeld. In other words, the it's not really a revolt. They're just criticizing the conduct of the war, and I think there's a lot of people who, certainly 68-69% of the American people, hold the same views, and they're looking to these flag and general officers to give it a little more than just an impression. They know. And just from the standpoint of not having enough troops, the lack of any kind of a plan, the notion that we broke up the Iraqi military and their police forces, that we disbanded them instead of, you know, it's one thing to take out the Ba'athist leaders, some of the Sunni and Ba'athist leaders loyal to Saddam Hussein, but certainly the general structure down the line would have been extremely useful. We didn't need to rebuild one from the ground up, and suddenly these guys are thrown out of work. They're no longer employed in the Army, and I guess a lot of them ended up, when they realized that there was going to be an occupation by the Americans, that they went over to the other side and became part of the insurgency, and they were the better trained Iraqi forces. But younger officers have joined. Junior and mid-level officers are discussing whether the war plans for Iraq reflected the proper unvarnished military advice, whether the retired generals should have spoken out, whether active duty generals should feel free to state their views in private sessions with civilian leaders, and most divisive of all, whether Rumsfeld should resign. They're kicking that around at the captain, major, and lieutenant colonel level.
Well, I think that he should resign, but what disturbs me is that President Bush insists that he has total confidence in him, and now he's talking about maybe a military strike on Iran, and where is the outcry from the American people? This is what disturbs me, and the president cannot do these things on his own. Doesn't Congress have the gumption to stand up and say, look, I mean, Iran is surrounded by people with nuclear weapons to the east. China has nuclear weapons to the south. Pakistan has nuclear weapons to the north. Russia has nuclear weapons. Why are we worried
Israel
about...
Israel has nuclear weapons.
Sure, sure. So why are we so worried about Iran? And recently, India has, you know, gone ahead and developed nuclear weapons. But we're not worried about India's nuclear weapons. We're going to help them develop their nuclear weapons. So is this really the issue, or is this simply an excuse to expand the war? We're going to be back in just a moment with Colonel Ron Ray. And, of course, these are such serious issues. An awful lot of Americans are being killed. An awful lot of Iraqis are being killed, innocent women and children. Well, you can call it collateral damage, call it what you will. Who's responsible if Saddam really didn't have weapons of mass destruction that threatened us? I mean, are we ever going to hold anybody responsible, or is it always going to be, aw, shucks, we just made a mistake? Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty. Our guest is Colonel Ron Ray. And, of course, as our young men are fighting for freedom, at least we're told they're fighting for freedom and democracy over in the Middle East, while we're losing our freedom here at home. If you read the Wall Street Journal the last couple of days, the military is collecting dossiers on all American citizens, tracking Americans through the military. What is the American military doing tracking civilians here at home? Well, of course, they're defending our country. At least that's what we're told. And, of course, we find that the government is tracking our telephone calls, is tracking our emails and our faxes. They've been doing that for years. It has nothing to do with terrorism. But what they're trying to do now is make this justified, saying, oh, they might somehow be a terrorist. And they're putting up those video cameras every place. And where is the outcry, the cry of outrage from the American people that in the name of fighting terrorism, we're taking the freedom away from the American people? Colonel, please pick up the story.
Well, that's an interesting point, because we keep hearing, why do they hate us so? And it's not because of an occupation. It's not because, as the Harvard and Chicago professors pointed out in the paper that was published at the John F. Kennedy School of Government, with all the footnotes from mainstream sources, basically said that since 1967 in the Middle East, our strategy has been to follow the Israeli strategy 100%. And that's created a lot of hate and discontent. But we're told from the president on down that they hate us because of our freedom and democracy. But you ask people about the election in 2000 and 2004, you ask about you know, how free our elections are, how well the democracy is working. There don't seem to be any checks and balances on this administration. And freedom, as you just pointed out, every day you pick up the paper, every day you look at the better sources of news and information in this country, you can see that there are further encroachments on Arlen Specter, of all people, is standing up, the chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee, is opposing one move by the administration to increase funding for domestic surveillance. Now, I'm not talking about foreign, intercepting foreign telephone conversations that might be involved with an Al-Qaeda operative or one thing or another, but I'm talking about domestic surveillance of civilians in this country, and he's standing up. But doesn't seem to be there's much of a check and balance in our society, which was based on, as Thomas Jefferson said, we're going to chain everyone down with the chains of the Constitution, that is, because of limited and separated powers. But the president seems to be, executive branch seems to exercise wholly unwarranted powers. You and I were talking on the phone the other day, Stan, and I think it's an interesting historical precedent. How far do we go back? One of the most radical administrations, a dramatic change in the way of the conduct of government occurred on March the 8th, 1933, when Franklin Roosevelt asked Congress for, in view of the economic crisis after the stock market crash in October of 1929 and the beginning of the depression that followed thereafter, he asked and got the war power, which gave him essentially dictatorial powers, as if we were tantamount to martial law. Those war powers have never been listed. Most Americans don't know that. There's some really excellent work done on that. But one of the proposals that Roosevelt brought out in 1933, when Douglas MacArthur, General MacArthur, was the chief of staff of the Army, was that we could save money in this crisis if we would furlough half of the officer corps of the United States Army.
Hold that thought there, Colonel. We'll be right back in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Colonel Ron Ray. And Colonel, we're simply talking about the dictatorial powers that the President of the United States took to himself in 1933, when Franklin Delano Roosevelt asked for war powers to be given to him in the middle of the Depression, which had been created by the Federal Reserve System, simply limiting the amount of money that was available and plunging us into this terrible, terrible time of suffering for the American people. So, if any of you would like to see a summary of those War Powers Act, we have something that was written up by Senator Frank Church, as I remember. Maybe it wasn't Church, but whoever it was, we have a very, very good analysis of that, which make it available to you. But then Colonel Ray was talking about how the president, to save money, decided that he was going to furlough half of the officers in the military. And so you pick up the story there.
Well, that was his announcement. He was going to start with the Army, 50% of the officer corps, and the idea that the training and the traditions and the discipline and the good order and discipline that's been established, half of them would be let go from the Army for 6 months without pay and allowances. At the end of the 6 months, we'd call them back, and then we'd furlough the other half for a six-month period as just a cost-cutting measure. Now, Douglas MacArthur heard about that and made the statements through channels, talked to the Secretary of the Army, protested respectfully, and the Secretary of the Army turned him down, went to the Secretary of War. Secretary of War turned him down, and he asked to see the Commander-in-Chief, which he had the authority to do, and he went to see the Commander-in-Chief, and this is what he said. This is carried out in the William Manchester, excellent historian, wrote in a book on MacArthur called American Caesar. It's recounted in that and other MacArthur biographies, but he told President Roosevelt, he said that what you propose would do more harm to the United States Army than all the wars that we've ever fought. The enemy in the field has never been able to inflict harm on the American Army like you're proposing to do would be the effect. I must protest, and if my refusal to carry that out, if you would fire me or force me to retire, I would do so. But Mr. President, let me remind you that what I would do, this is so deadly to us, that I would go to every American Legion Hall, every veterans organization in every state in the Union, and explain why I oppose your measure that would do such harm to us, to interfere with the flow of training and the breakup of the chain of command that you would propose to do. And when he left the White House, Manchester records that he actually threw up on the lawn of the White House, because this was certainly contrary to what he'd been taught, duty, honor, country at West Point, and the soldier that he was, for him to be making the stand that he was doing in a proper way, went back and started to pack up his things in his office in the Army headquarters in the War Department, and Roosevelt backed down because MacArthur was not going to go quietly into the night. MacArthur, even he was going to speak out, and would do so as a retired officer. And I think that is very instructive to us today, that we see the retired officer speaking out, and regardless of what Tony Blankley and Maureen Dodd and so many of the talking heads are doing in the newspapers that are trying to talk about dishonor and a revolt and all that, the things they're saying and speaking out on are entirely appropriate, and that they're not violations of the Uniform Code of Military Justice, and they're not speaking disparagingly. They're talking about our policy, the conduct of the war, and many of them are calling for the Secretary of Defense to resign.
I agree with it totally. And of course, MacArthur did have the courage again to speak out during the Korean War and help to bring that senseless conflict to an end. And I think really what we have to point out is that, you know, if the generals don't speak out, how are we ever going to know that the military is totally against this war? It has been fought wrong. It has been prolonged unnecessarily. And Americans are dying because Donald Rumsfeld has an agenda. And I don't believe this agenda is good for America. And if they don't speak out, who will? I'm proud of them.
Well, that's right. And they've played a role. And, of course, Charles Krauthammer, a neocon, has written several articles, a disturbing precedent, and makes it sound like the Constitution has been torn in shatters because these men have dared to speak their mind and their heart, but nothing could be further than the truth. And we pointed towards 7 days in May, which was a novel made into a movie some might have seen 20 or 25 years ago, based on an actual event that occurred during the Roosevelt administration.
Oh, that was I remember that, certainly. That was Chesty Pullen.
Smedley Butler,
I'm
General
sorry.
Smedley Butler, who came to the aid of Roosevelt when there were a group of industrialists who were trying to encourage a coup among retired veterans, Army veterans and military veterans, and they tried to get Smedley Butler to lead it, and he tipped the president off to this, which would be a revolt, which would be a revolutionary, which would have been
an
attempted coup d'etat.
Well, the This is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and our guest is Colonel Ron Ray. And, of course, what we tragically have in the House of Representatives is a bunch of wimps. And, you know, at least Congressman Murtha had the courage to get up and put forward a resolution saying we should pull our troops out as soon as is possible, not immediately, but as soon as is feasible, and keep some of them there in another country. They could come back and help if things really got out of hand. A brigade or two of Marines. But, of course, what the Republican leadership did was to put up a resolution they knew would fail. And that was immediately pull out all of our troops. Now, who in their right mind would say we ought to immediately pull out all of our troops and not at least give the Iraqis a chance to begin making some plans for it? And the Democrat leadership, which should have, of course, have encouraged Congressman Murtha's resolution, they backed the Republican resolution, knowing that I think only three congressmen voted for it, including Congressman Murtha even voted against it. So they play these sort of games, and American boys continue dying unnecessarily, and Iraqi women continue dying unnecessarily, and Iraqi children and Iraqi civilians of all sorts. And of course, what we're doing is inflaming the entire Arab world against America. They're a lot smarter than the American people. They ask, why did America go into Afghanistan? The Afghans offered to give up Osama bin Laden, at least to send him out of the country so we could have captured him. You know, and if Osama was such a wicked guy, why did we finance the Taliban all during the years when Osama was being given sanctuary in Afghanistan, and yet we were financing the Taliban during that time? So why, if he was such a bad guy, if Osama was such a bad guy, did we finance the people who were giving him a sanctuary? And there's so much to this story the American people don't know. But the Arabs do know, and they know that the reasons that are given to the American people are just not true. And they look upon this as the Crusaders returning to take back their holy land. And who's to say that perhaps there's not some element of truth to that? Colonel, pick up the story.
Well, I just think it's an interesting thing that this proper role of the military in American life just shows you that what's happened is that the precedents, the tradition, the principles of the Constitution are a limited form of government. It was extremely important to the Founding Fathers that you might recall that George Washington was offered the opportunity to be king of America, and he rejected the notion. He even rejected the notion of assuming going from commander-in-chief of the army to the leader of the country, which is really what Cromwell did, based on that historical precedent where he became the Lord Protector of England. In other words, at the head of an army, he became the head of the government while he was still head of the army. And George Washington set a very important precedent for us in terms of civil authority over our armed forces.
Hold that thought, please, Colonel. We'll be right back in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Colonel, go right ahead. Pick up the story there. Colonel Ray was simply showing that the precedent here in the United States would be that, you know, we would not have a dictator, we would not have a military rule, and that the president had to be elected, and that the military was to be separate from the presidency, but it was to be answerable not to the president. It was to be answerable to Congress. Only Congress could declare war. Only Congress could fund military adventures.
Question about that, Stan. And I mean, he did it in a very powerful way. Washington actually resigned his commission as commander-in-chief and returned to Mount Vernon, from which he was called, you know, by the people and elected, called by the leaders and called by the elected official to be duly elected as president of the United States. And therefore, that principle was established. But if you look at the Federalist Papers, you know, James Madison, the father of the Constitution, you know, in his political observations in 1795, also that he did in the Federalist Papers, gave some reasons for giving a purely military cast to the chief executive's authorities, commander-in-chief. If you go in the Secretary of Defense, formerly the Secretary of War's office, he's got an American flag and he's got a four-star flag. Why is that? The Secretary of Defense wears a coat and tie. But his authority, while he may be a civilian, that is, he's not enlisted, enrolled in, formally sworn in as an officer of the United States Armed Forces, all of his authority is military. It comes from the Commander-in-Chief authority of the President. So the Commander-in-Chief, when he exercises Commander-in-Chief authority, might as well be having a five-star rank. But when he's the chief executive, he's the chief executive. When he's commander-in-chief, he's commander-in-chief. And he used to assume that responsibility when he was given that responsibility by Congress. This is what Madison said. The powers proposed to be surrendered to the executive, the power to raise an army, the power to declare war, were those which the Constitution has most jealously appropriated to the legislature. The Constitution expressly and exclusively vests in the legislature the power of declaring a state of war, the power of raising the armies, the power of creating offices. In other words, this delegation of the power would have been to make the president a king. And what's happened is, Stan, the perversion of this occurred during the Cold War, when apparently the president could operate as commander-in-chief whenever he chose to, because this period of Cold War existed. So what happened was, in Korea, although Harry Truman went to Capitol Hill, and this has now been uncovered in the archives and the Truman Library and whatnot, he actually went up and said, "I think you fellows ought to give me a declaration of war." And they said, "No, Harry, we really don't need to do that. I mean, we've been operating under different principles, and we're behind you. You go ahead and do it." But Truman had the proper perspective. So from that time on, we've seen a president gaining more and more and more and more authority, to where you see George Bush, exercises the kind of power that Madison and Washington and the Founding Fathers indicated should never be vested in a president. They retained the civil authority over our armed forces, including the commander-in-chief, which is a military office. And I think it's very important for your listeners to understand that the president of the United States wears two hats: chief executive, a civilian, commander-in-chief, that's a military authority. So even though he wears a coat and tie, that doesn't make him a civilian for that purpose. The civil authority is the Congress, and they've abdicated that responsibility now for 56 years, since June of 1950.
Well, of course, the thing that concerns me, Colonel, is the fact that it would appear that the Bush administration is hell-bent upon some sort of a conflict with Iran. I mean, they're going through all the steps just like they did before the attack on Iraq. Oh, we're going to go to the United Nations, and we're going to offer to negotiate, but we really don't want to negotiate. It appears that we want an excuse to bomb Iran, and whether we kill a few thousand or a few million, this is going to have terrible repercussions, not only our relationships with Iran, but throughout the rest of the world. And, of course, the Iranians then can certainly unleash their armies to go into Iraq and go after our boys there. Our boys would be simply sitting ducks under those situations. I mean, Iran is getting their intermediate-range missiles now from North Korea, which is getting the technology from Communist China, which got the technology from the United States. Thanks to Bill Clinton, who supposedly got a couple of $100,000 in campaign contributions. I don't think that's it at all. I think this thing is long-range planning. But, you know, certainly with those missiles, they could reach Europe, they could reach Israel. And we're looking at the potential, you know, for World War III. And where is the outcry from our Congress?
Well, of course, this plan was written by Paul Wolfowitz and others in the 70s after the debacle of the October 1973 war. There's an excellent book, I'm sure that you all probably carry it, or you've recommended it before, James Bamford's book, A Pretext for War.
Yes, sir, that's an excellent book.
Excellent book, and Bamford writes about this. He quotes this whole thing. One military, this is a quote from Bamford's book, one military officer complained that Miller sometimes, this is the New York Times, intimidates Army soldiers by invoking Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld or Undersecretary Douglas Feith. And Miller was the one, Judith Miller, in the whole leak case, was incarcerated and supported by the Times for a while. She's no longer with the Times now. But if you would look at that particular book and look at the Project for the New American Century .org website and see what was said in 1997. I know your listeners are pretty astute, and they got a lot of information, and you have some excellent guests on your shows, Dr. Stan. But it's very, very, very clear how far back this goes. George Herbert Walker Bush was pressed as hard as you could press a president of the United States to go from Kuwait on up into Baghdad and to Baghdad and to overthrow Saddam Hussein. He refused for all the reasons that are carried out in his book, A World Transformed, that he wrote with Brent Scowcroft, Lieutenant General, who was his national security advisor. And Bill Clinton was pressed very hard in 1996 to invade Iraq and go up to Baghdad. And he refused to do that. He even counseled with George Herbert Walker Bush. And then in 1997, a lot of the men involved, these so-called neocons, had proposed a similar program to Benjamin Netanyahu, who was then Prime Minister of Israel, and his refusal to accept this program. So here's a program that's been rejected by George Herbert Walker Bush, rejected by Bill Clinton, rejected by the Prime Minister of Israel, Benjamin Netanyahu, the Project for the New American Century was, the website was put up and went public in 1997. Remember, Irving Kristol put his editorial in the Wall Street Journal that what we need is a new enemy that can unite us in opposition. But the website went up in 1997, and you see who the signatories are on all that, and you begin to see these are the same people that staff the State Department, the National Security Council, the Defense Policy Board, and the Department of Defense.
No, that would be Rumsfeld, Cheney, Wolfowitz, Bolton, Liddy, the current Elliot Abrams, the current
Richard Perle, the chairman of the Defense Policy Board, and many others. And in fact, Dan Quayle signed off to the governor of Florida, Jeb Bush, the president's brother, signed off. And there's 26 or 27 folks that you'll all recognize their names. So the American people need to be informed, and they need to demand that Congress will assume the proper authority, a civil authority over the armed forces. They need to do this to restore the checks and balances our Constitution intended. There are 12 specific war powers in the Constitution. Article 1 is Congress, and there's a reason why they're the first among equals. The people's house. We elect them. And of course, the senators used to be elected by the state legislatures. They were statesmen because they represented the states. But the point was, we have the first power, that the civil authority of the Congress of the United States, is the power to provide for the common defense, the right to declare war, that a state of war, that actions on the ground, actions that have occurred, constitute acts of war. And therefore, we change the relationship between the parties to where a state of war exists. The right to declare war is number two. The right to grant letters of marque and reprisal. And the power to make rules concerning captures on land and water. The power to raise and support armies. Six, the power to provide and maintain a navy. Seven, the power to make rules for the government and regulation of the land and naval forces. The power to define and punish piracies, the power to erect forts, magazines, arsenals, dockyards, and other needful buildings, the power to make all needful rules and regulations respecting the property and territory of the United States, the power to declare the punishment of treason, levying war against the United States or adhering to their enemies, giving them aid and comfort. And obviously they have the power to remove, convict, and impeach the president, the vice president, and all the civil officers of the United States for treason, bribery, or other high crimes and misdemeanors. So those war powers are the only power the president in Article 2 has is that he shall be the commander-in-chief. That means he's the commander-in-chief. A military office, he's the military officer in terms of the tactics and strategy of the war. But the power retains to Congress, and if we don't readdress that, I think we'll see ourselves in a place where we could find a state of martial law, or certainly something worse than the soft tyranny, or somebody called it a soft dictatorship that's already been established.
Well, I share your concern. What really bothers me is that it appears that the people in government have no respect for the law. I mean, the president said, I would not support torture at all, but of course, if you pass a bill outlawing it, I will veto it. Well, that's sort of a mixed message. If you don't support it, why would you threaten to veto a law that says you couldn't torture prisoners? And we see there's so many of the things that really do not represent American values. I mean, the handling of the people over there. I mean, these people are terribly, terribly impoverished, and a lot of them are far worse off than they were before, and they don't have jobs, and they don't have electricity, and they don't have water, and they don't have any hope for the future. And a little wonder why some of them have joined the insurgency to get rid of the occupiers. They look upon America as an occupying nation.
Now, well, there's no question. There's no question, Stan. There's no question. And in many ways, the parallel, there's two immediate parallels that I've made on national television shows. And, you know, obviously what happened in Algeria with the French, you know, in the late 50s and early 60s, the occupation, and finally there really was the colonel's revolt, the wolves in the city that occurred in Algiers. But it was the same kind. It was an occupation. It was a police intelligence kind of a thing, and they ended up torturing prisoners to try to get the intelligence they needed to find out what the plans were and all that kind of thing. But similarly, the United States declared war against Spain after the controversial sinking of the USS Maine in February of 1898 in Havana Harbor. And then, by the way, the mast of the USS Maine is in Arlington Cemetery. You can see it. If you visit there, they put it up there. But that was the basis to get us in the war. Against Spain, we wanted Cuba, and we had desires on the Philippines. And we defeated the Spanish army, both in Cuba as well as in the Philippines, in short order. But what took much longer is that the casualties that the Americans took, they took when it became apparent, particularly to the Filipinos, that we intended to stay as an occupier. And that's when we took 5,000 or 6,000 casualties.
Of course, nobody ever mentions that about somewhere between 200,000 and a million Filipinos died.
No question about that. Nobody ever mentions that.
Well, they were only Filipinos. And where is the outcry from the American people? Why don't they ever teach the true history of what's going on, that this was the first of our imperialistic wars, that it was an imperialistic war? And every battle we've been in since then has been an imperialistic war, all aimed at one thing, the establishment of a new world order. And, of course, a new world religion.
Well, it's certainly clear if you really think that the war on terror is as it's represented to us, then all you have to do is look at the lack of control of our borders to let you know that what we're being told about the war on terror is not so, because the first thing you do to have national security is to be able to secure the borders of what constitutes your country.
Well, of course, I always like to think about when I get on the airplane, I have to take off my shoes and my belt and my coat and my wallet and my watch and put them all in there. But they will not allow the airlines to profile people of a Middle Eastern origin. Now, how many terrorists do you know who are not Middle Eastern? How many of those on the 11th of September 2001 were not Middle Eastern? Why won't they let them profile Middle Easterners? Oh, we wouldn't want to offend anybody. If we're really involved in a war on terrorism, do you think they'd be concerned at all about offending people? Are they worried about offending the civilians over in Iraq? Or is this all a matter of perception? Are we being convinced of something that really isn't true?
Well, and we're being conditioned to, you know, notice that you can be a non-citizen and cross our border almost with impunity now. Particularly the southern border, and they're coming up, and there have been many examples of folks from hostile nations who've come in across those borders. But you can't get on, an American citizen can't get on an airplane without being subjected to greater scrutiny than I was scrutinized. Caspar Weinberger, may his soul rest in peace, I went on a mission for him to Berlin and to East Germany in the height of the Cold War in October of 1984, official responsibilities, Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense, and I was subjected to much less scrutiny, okay, going into a totalitarian country on the other side of the Iron Curtain than I am if I go on an American airplane today. And I think that it's clear that we should be given that kind of scrutiny to those that come across our border who are non-citizens, rather than give that scrutiny to U.S. citizens. So we're being conditioned to line up and be treated as if we were a threat to this country.
And
those who are non-citizens are being treated as if they were guests in our country, and they want to pass an amnesty under the guise of guest workership, so that you know that whatever the war on terror is said to be is not what it's represented to be, or we would have secured the borders immediately after 9/11.
You're absolutely right. In fact, Paul Williams' book, The Al-Qaeda Connection, points out that tens of thousands of people from terrorist nations have crossed the southern border, come into this country when they've been picked up, and about 10,000 of them were. They were immediately put in a hotel room, given a hearing, told to come back for a definitive hearing. And, you know, nobody ever came back. They just faded into our community. How many of them are terrorists? We don't know. We won't find out until the word is given. But it doesn't make sense. You could not do such a thing, be so foolish unintentionally. Colonel, how can people get in touch with you?
Well, they can. FirstPrinciplesPress.org is a website that has a lot of information and contact information. That's FirstPrinciplesPress.org. FirstPrinciplesPress.org, and if they'd like information or wish to get in touch with me, they can email me at ColonelRay@AYE.net.
Okay, fine. Well, we've got just a couple of minutes more now before we go to our let you go, but what's the final thought you'd like to leave with our listeners?
Well, I'm going to leave Alexander Hamilton's own words in Federalist Number 69, and this was about the executive power which our Constitution contains. This is what he said. The President is the Commander-in-Chief of the Army and Navy of the United States. In this respect, his authority would be nominally the same as the King of Britain, but in substance much inferior to it. It would amount to nothing more than the supreme command and direction of the military and naval forces as the General and Admiral of the Confederacy, while that of the British King extends to the right to declare war, to raise and regulate the fleets and armies, all of which, by the Constitution, appertain only to the legislature. That principle needs to be restored. And most of the congressmen and senators don't know what the civil authority means. You hear civilian control, they see Donald Rumsfeld wearing a coat and tie, and they assume he's a civilian, therefore he should control what goes on. That's not at all. He's exercising only military authority, as George W. Bush is. The civil authority is Congress. Let's get that word to congressmen and hope that a few of our senators will begin to understand it.
And, of course, the major problem is today that most of our congressmen and most of our senators do not understand the Constitution they've sworn to uphold. We do not want another King George in the White House. We want an executive who will carry out the assignment assigned to him under our Constitution, where the power to declare war and the power over the people is to be maintained by the members of Congress who are answerable to the people. And I think that's the big problem, isn't it, Colonel?
No question about it. We need to understand that it's limited in limited in separated powers, and that is extremely important. And if we can't exist, liberty and justice for all is impossible without that. And getting a handle on the people with the authority to use deadly force, the police, the military, to bring that back under the sheriff of each county, as the chief law enforcement officer of each county, the limitations of those powers, that's probably the most important thing we can do. I certainly spend a lot of time in Washington trying to ensure that the military still enjoys the right to pray, that virtue, honor, patriotism are taught and enforced the way they used to be, and that if somebody encourages them to turn their weapons on the American people, that they'll refuse.
I hope so, too. Colonel, thank you for everything you do, and we'll look forward to having you again on one of our programs real soon.
See you in Washington in a few weeks, Tuesday.
Good night.
All the best to you.
Oh, you will be there. Good. I'm looking forward to it.
Bye-bye.
Thanks. Bye-bye. Okay, that was Colonel Ron Ray. And, of course, if you'd like to get all that material from the Project for the New American Century, it's included in our Iraq, the Untold Story syllabus. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, and our guest, Colonel Ron Ray, and certainly one of my favorite people, a good personal friend. Well, I would point out that if you'd like to get the information on the Project for the New American Century, their website is newamericancentury.org. That's newamericancentury.org. Or if you'd like to get it, we've included that in our Iraq, the Untold Story syllabus, along with, of course, so much documentation on the fact that all of the wars of the last century were contrived. And you'll see a lot of the original documentation. The dropping of the bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, totally unnecessary. The Japanese had offered to surrender, but then so had the Germans. They wanted the war to go on and on and on. And, of course, this is the terrible tragedy. We have a very good talk that goes with the syllabus. It's called Iraq, the Untold Story. So you get the syllabus, and you can get the video, or you can get them both together. We hope that you'll get them and help us get the truth out across America. If you have not yet read my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, you need to get it. You need to get other copies, and if you buy them in bulk, we'll cut the price down and get people to understand the spiritual nature of the battle we're engaged in. And it's also available on DVD or on video. That's the Brotherhood of Darkness. My talk on the world revolution will give you an excellent overview of what's going on and the satanic nature of what we're up against. And here you'll actually see my interview in 1980 with Ambassador Earl Smith. We took a film crew to Palm Beach, Florida, and interviewed the ambassador who was there at the time. We turned Cuba over to a known communist. He will tell you we knew Fidel Castro was a communist. Of course we knew Fidel Castro was a communist, and we turned the country over to him. But we can't let the American people understand that. They were financing communism throughout the world today. Just as recently, we've made sure that the Maoists are going to win in Nepal. And we made sure, of course, that the communists were to win in Rhodesia and South Africa and Southwest Africa and Angola. And why would you do anything like that? Because there's a world revolution going on. And behind all of it is secret societies. And that's why my talk on the world revolution is so important. And, of course, if you want the documentation on what I'm saying, the book written by the Librarian of Congress is entitled Fire in the Minds of Men. Now, he totally ignores the influence of the World Revolution in America because he's a Librarian of Congress. And you go there and you go through their catalog, you won't find any mention of the Illuminati. They have only a few documents on it, and they don't want you to see them. We were able to get the one on the Clintonian Illuminati, 1803. Where do you think it was? In the Jefferson Collection. How did we get it? Well, that's another story, but Dr. Dennis Cuddy and I worked very hard to liberate that, and we make it available to you. Yes, the Illuminati was here. The Jacobins were, of course, the front group for the Illuminati, and the Democratic Clubs were the front group for the Jacobins, and of course, you really want to get my April newsletter, which we're just finishing up now, which will help to tie together all of the embedded messages, the secret coded messages in George Bush's speeches. And they're there, and you listen to the speech, you have no idea what he's talking about, but you don't want to admit that you don't know what he's talking about, so you just nod and say, wasn't that beautiful? But the coded messages are there for those people who understand the esoteric background of what's going on. So we ask you, of course, to certainly go to our website at RadioLiberty.com. That's RadioLiberty.com. If you'd like to get a free newsletter or you'd like to join the Radio Liberty family and help us, our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. I want to remind you about the conspiracy conference that's going to be held. It's going to be held in the Hyatt Regency Hotel, and it's going to be held there on the 27th and 28th of May. I'm going to be speaking, as are, of course, a number of the people we have here on a regular basis. For more information on the conspiracy conference, call 209-832-0999. That's 209-832-0999. There's some way out people there. There's some excellent people. Ted Gunderson's going to be there, Jim Mars, John DeCamp, Will Thomas. Anyway, look forward to seeing you again. The number 209-832-0999 or conspiracycon.com. And then please pray for America. Pray for revival. Pray for our leaders and our ministers. Please pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and protection. And so until at the same time, may the Lord be with you.